The court says okay to the travel ban. Democrats in New York say N-O to Joe Crowley. And Anthony Kennedy's retirement sets up a political tsunami for 2018. All rise for the Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. With Justice Kennedy on his way out, President Trump gets another chance to shape the Supreme Court for decades to come.
President Donald Trump is going to get to replace him with a justice who presumably will be more conservative than Kennedy is, could move the court significantly to the right.
Meanwhile, as House Democrats react to Joe Crowley's startling defeat, how big is the chasm between the party establishment and its angry progressive insurgents?
They've enjoyed watching Republicans eat themselves alive in primaries, but winter has come for the Democratic Party.
And a new study shows that a growing number of Americans fear for the future of democracy. Is it too late to restore civility in politics? It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 235 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Tuesday was the biggest one-day primary show of the year, as voters in six states went to the polls. But it was hardly a Super Tuesday for Joe Crowley, the Queens congressman and number four Democrat in the House. In a stunning upset, Crowley lost his bid for an 11th term to 28-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. More of that shocker later in the program. Elsewhere in New York, Dan Donovan, a Republican from Staten Island's 11th District, easily defeated the comeback attempt of his predecessor, Michael Grimm, who left Congress following his conviction on fraud, tax evasion, and perjury charges. In western New York, the Democratic primary in the 25th District, centered in Rochester, went to the state assembly's majority leader, Joe Morelli. It's for the seat long held by the late Louise Slaughter. In Maryland, Ben Jealous, the former president of the NAACP, backed by Bernie Sanders and other progressives, defeated fellow African-American Rashern Baker, the Prince George's County executive. Here's Jealous on primary night.
Now, I know people will look at the results today and try to discern the meaning of our victory, like my little son's trying to discern what a teleprompter is. Well, let me tell you what I've been telling voters for months. I'm not running to the left. I'm not running to the right. I'm running towards the people of our state.
Jealous faces an uphill battle against popular GOP Governor Larry Hogan in November. In the Maryland Senate race, where incumbent Democrat Ben Cardin's renomination was never in doubt, it's worth noting that one of his challengers, Chelsea Manning, the former Bradley Manning and noted WikiLeaker, received less than 6% of the vote. In Colorado, where Democratic Governor John Hickenlooper is term limited, the battle will be between Congressman Jared Polis, a Democrat, and State Treasurer Walker Stapleton, the Republican. Oklahoma is another state where its governor, Republican Mary Fallon, is ineligible to seek a third term. Democrats nominated former State Attorney General Drew Edmondson. No Republican managed to win a majority of the vote, so we won't know the GOP nominee until August 28th, the date of the runoff. Speaking of runoffs, South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster, armed with a campaign visit from President Trump, won his race against Marine veteran John Warren. McMaster became governor when Nikki Haley was tapped to become UN ambassador. And Mitt Romney, as expected, was the easy Republican primary winner in Utah for the Senate seat Orrin Hatch is vacating after seven terms. Here's Romney on primary night battling the wind.
We also welcome immigrants and refugees who come here legally. They add to the vitality of our great country. We prize education and rigorous debate, and we expect the people who are our leaders to carry out these debates with civility and dignity.
The former presidential candidate and Massachusetts governor is heavily favored in the November general election. But the defeat of New York Congressman Joe Crowley was the big surprise from Tuesday's primaries, And so, of course, it leads to this week's trivia question. Who is the last male Democratic member of the House beaten in the primary by a non-incumbent woman? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. The news was not surprising, but it was certainly earth-shattering. Anthony Kennedy, considered the swing justice on the United States Supreme Court, announced on Wednesday he's retiring. Kennedy is a conservative, but has cast key votes for same-sex marriage, abortion rights, and affirmative action. His decision gives President Trump a second pick to transform the court, a court that is likely to move even further to the right. The announcement came a day after Trump won a big victory from the justices. In a 5-4 ruling, the court upheld the president's travel ban that was aimed at several predominantly Muslim countries. The Trump administration argued that it was done in the name of national security. Opponents said it was religious discrimination. The president was ecstatic about the decision.
Today's Supreme Court ruling, just coming out, a tremendous success, a tremendous victory for the American people. And for our Constitution. This is a great victory for our Constitution. We have to be tough and we have to be safe and we have to be secure. At a minimum, we have to make sure that we vet people coming into the country. We know who's coming in. We know where they're coming from. We just have to know who's coming here.
There was a little chest bumping as well.
The ruling shows that all of the attacks from the media and the Democrat politicians are wrong, and they turned out to be very wrong. And what we're looking for as Republicans, I can tell you, is strong borders, no crime. What the Democrats are looking at is open borders, which will bring tremendous crime. It'll bring MS-13 and lots of others that we don't want to have in our country.
For what it all means, and I'm talking about Kennedy as well as the travel ban, we turn to Amy Howe, who blogs on the Supreme Court at amylhowe.com. She's also an independent contractor and reporter for SCOTUS Blog. Amy, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Great to talk to you again.
Well, Amy, I figured you're not doing much today on this Wednesday. Oh, my goodness gracious. You know, speculation about Kennedy retiring is not new, and you and I have talked about it several times in the past, but when the news came, I don't know any other word other than earth-shattering.
That's right. One thing that, you know, for many of us who follow the court on a regular basis seemed to suggest that perhaps Kennedy wouldn't retire was that the last couple of justices who have retired, Justice John Paul Stevens and Justice David Souter, announced their retirement in the spring, in late April and early May, to give the president time to nominate someone. They held hearings over the summer, and then the new Supreme Court justice can be on the bench when they return in the fall. And so there was a sense that Kennedy is someone who respects this kind of process, and that once that window closed, perhaps he was going to stay on the bench for at least another term. Things began to shift a little bit earlier this week. This month, the Supreme Court essentially punted, for lack of a better legal term, on a couple of important legal issues, including partisan gerrymandering and the Masterpiece Cake Shop ruling, whether a baker could decline to provide a custom cake to a same-sex couple because that would violate his religious beliefs. And so there was a sense that when they punted on that and then they turned down a couple of cases involving the same issues, that perhaps the Supreme Court didn't want to have these issues sitting on their docket so that they could be sort of a lightning rod in a confirmation process over the summer. And then perhaps this should have been a sign that we should have paid a little more attention to more closely. Apparently, Justice Kennedy's wife, Mary, and three of their grandchildren were at the Supreme Court today, and we now know that that was to see Justice Kennedy's final day on the bench.
You're talking about it on Wednesday, yeah. Well, you know, some might say that Kennedy is a conservative and he'll be replaced by a conservative, so it's not so much of a big deal. I know that's not the case, and I know you know that's not the case. Explain why that's not the case.
He was certainly was appointed by a Republican president, and he is more conservative than he is liberal. And in fact, this term, in each and every 5-4 decision when he was in the five, he sided with the more conservative justices rather with the liberals. But he has been, I don't think he likes this term, but it's a good way to refer to it, he's been the swing justice on a lot of important issues recently, like same-sex marriage, like affirmative action, like abortion. And so the prospect for liberals that he's going to retire and President Donald Trump is going to get to replace him with a justice who presumably will be more conservative than Kennedy is on these issues could move the court significantly to the right.
Who becomes the swing justice now, or is there no longer one on the court?
Obviously, it depends on who the president nominates, but Chief Justice John Roberts could very well find himself as the swing justice rather than Kennedy, because he's perhaps the most liberal of the conservative justices. But, you know, it's hard to imagine on some of these issues that we're talking about, like same-sex marriage, like abortion, like affirmative action. You know, his votes are not really in doubt, and so he wouldn't necessarily be sort of vacillating one way or the other on some of these hot-button issues.
I mean, I was thinking of that because once upon a time, Sandra Day O'Connor was considered the swing justice. And then when she left the court, Anthony Kennedy, who was more conservative than O'Connor, became the swing justice. And now that the court has moved even further, likely to move even further to the right, I was just wondering if there is somebody whose vote is in suspense when those 5-4 decisions are about to be announced.
I do think that Roberts is really probably the only possibility. The president has made clear that he wants to appoint someone in the mold of Justice Antonin Scalia or Justice Clarence Thomas. And so that person is more likely to be more conservative than Chief Justice John Roberts. But I'm not sure that he's going to be much of a swing justice.
How much lobbying do you think there was on Kennedy to hang on as long as he could?
You know, I'm not sure where he would hear it from. I think that there are certainly many people who would have preferred that he not retire right now, particularly before the midterms, at the very least wait until after the midterms in the hope that maybe the Democrats could take control of the Senate. But you don't really get to tell a Supreme Court justice what to do. And you know, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has deeply resented, I think, efforts to try to convince her to retire during the Obama administration. So I doubt there was actually much in the way of lobbying.
Oh, my goodness. How much thought is there right now about Ruth Bader Ginsburg among liberals about how important it is for her to stay on the court?
I think the liberals would probably like to wrap her in bubble wrap and keep her in a climate-controlled room for the next decade or so, yes.
Have you heard any names of potential successors to Kennedy?
One name that has already been popping up is Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who's a very well-respected judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, which is, you know, often regarded as sort of the second most important court in the land. It's where, you know, Justice Thomas, Justice Ginsburg, Chief Justice John Roberts, Antonin Scalia all came from. He worked in the Bush administration. He's relatively young and very well regarded. Another name that has been floated again is William Pryor, who is a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit in Alabama and was apparently on the short list to fill the vacancy left by Justice Scalia's death. He would be a little bit more of a lightning rod. He's made some comments about abortion that I think that might not ultimately prevent him from being confirmed, but might make it a harder process than the Trump administration might like Don Willette, who's a judge on the Fifth Circuit, used to be a justice on the Texas Supreme Court, has also been mentioned. He has a very compelling personal story. He grew up, you know, quite poor and went on to become a Texas Supreme Court justice and then a judge. He was well known for having a very active Twitter account that he has slowed down significantly since becoming a federal judge. But one of the most intriguing parts of that is that he had at times been quite critical of candidate and then President Trump on his Twitter account. So it'll be fascinating to see whether that winds up playing a role in whether or not how seriously he's considered for the vacancy.
I suspect one name that you're not going to hear is Merrick Garland.
The president has already said he's going to choose from the list of names that he'd released, and I'm pretty sure Merrick Garland is not on that list.
Okay, let me go to Tuesday's court decision about the Muslim ban. This decision came after many lower courts, and there was challenges in several states like Hawaii, went against the president. Can you walk us through these earlier disappointments?
Sure. So there had been several rounds of litigation with earlier orders, and the president issued this order in September of 2017. The state of Hawaii challenged it in federal court, and a federal district court in Hawaii put the order on hold, said that the Trump administration can't enforce it because it violates federal immigration law. And the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit left that ruling in place, keeping the order on hold. The Trump administration went last year to the Supreme Court and asked it to allow the Trump administration to enforce the order while it litigated the case up to the Supreme Court. And this was kind of a key development that made it not very much of a surprise on Tuesday that the Supreme Court did rule for the Trump administration. You need 5 votes to do what's called stay the lower court ruling, to put the district court ruling on hold and allow the Trump administration to enforce the order. And they got the 5 votes. And so that strongly suggested that there were going to be 5 votes on the Supreme Court to uphold the order. And as it turned out, there were.
Let me play a little piece of tape of what Donald Trump said in 2015 during the campaign.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Amy, does the court decision, did that play into any of the calculations and the considerations of the court?
That was a primary argument that the state of Hawaii was making. There were 2 arguments. One is that it exceeded the president's powers under federal immigration law. And then the second argument was, putting that aside, federal immigration law, this violates the Constitution because the government isn't allowed to favor one religion over another or disfavor a religion like Islam. And the state of Hawaii said in this case, these kinds of statements make clear that this was a Muslim ban, and therefore it's unconstitutional. And the 5-justice majority on the Supreme Court, there was a sort of a subtle rebuke of the president. They hinted that really this was not a good idea for the president to say things like this. But they said, even if we're going to consider these statements, the Trump administration has said that it enacted this order for national security reasons, that the countries on this list were the countries that were not providing enough information to U.S. officials to give people at the embassies and the consulates enough confidence that they were able to vet people who wanted to come to the United States properly. And the 5-justice majority said, we're not going to second-guess that. This is a detailed order that sort of walks through how they arrived at this determination. It doesn't apply just to Muslims. There is a way for people to get waivers, even if you're from one of the countries that's listed on the order. If you can meet criteria, you might still be able to come to the United States. And so, therefore, we're going to uphold it.
Although in the dissent written by Justice Sotomayor, she referred to Trump's history of making negative comments about Muslims.
That's right. You know, her argument was much along the lines of what the state of Hawaii's has been, which is essentially that this is old wine in new bottles. They may have dress this up so that it doesn't look like it's targeting Muslims, but it is.
In the end, does a court decision effectively end any challenge to the so-called Muslim ban?
I think it will be a very hard challenge. One of the things that Justice Stephen Breyer raised in his dissent, which was joined by Justice Kagan, was that the majority in upholding the ban points to the idea that there are these exemptions and there are these waivers that make it possible for people to come to the United States, even if they're citizens of one of the countries on the list. But he said, we're not so sure actually that is how it's going to work in practice. There was an affidavit submitted by a U.S. consular official who called, in essence, the waiver process a sham, that nobody actually gets a waiver. We're not allowed to give waivers. So, you know, it's possible that something could happen in the lower courts, but I think that the challenge is effectively over.
Amy Howe blogs on the Supreme Court at amylhowe.com. She's also an independent contractor and reporter for SCOTUS Blog. Amy, thank you so much for your insight.
Always great to talk to you.
Someone's knocking at the door. Somebody ringing the bell. Someone knocking at the door. Somebody ringing the bell. Do me a favor. Open the door. Let them in.
The big news Tuesday was the stunning defeat in New York of Joe Crowley, the number 4 Democrat in the House, by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a 28-year-old first-time candidate who's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. Appearing Wednesday morning on MSNBC's Morning Joe program, Ocasio-Cortez explained how she won.
Our campaign was focused on just a laser-focused message of economic, social, and racial dignity for working-class Americans, especially those in Queens and the Bronx. We're very clear about our message, very clear about our priorities, and very clear about the fact that even if you've never voted before, we are talking to you.
And she said this on CNN.
We won because we organized. We won because I think we had a very clear winning message, and we took that message to doors that had never been knocked on before. Mm. We spoke to communities that had typically been, I think, dismissed, and they responded. You know, when people feel like they are being spoken directly to, I do feel like they are willing, they'll do things like turn out in an off-year midterm primary.
Nathan Gonzalez is the editor and publisher of Inside Elections and is an expert on House races. Nathan, wow, that was an upset.
Yeah, I'm surprised that there seem to be people now after the fact that seem to say, oh, well, of course Joe Crowley lost. And like, well, where were you before these votes were counted? But I think it's a legitimate surprise, at least to me.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, we knew there was a challenge. He hadn't been challenged, I don't think, in 14 years in a primary, but he had 10 times the money that she had. He had the party establishment. Well, he is the party establishment. I mean, yes, he was nervous about a challenge from the left-wing flank, and he's no conservative. He's a progressive liberal too, right?
Right. I think what was, you know, there's a lot of different ways to look at this. I think one of the things that was striking to me on Tuesday night as I watched the debate where he did show up, I watched it as he was about to lose, but on New York One, Crowley's message was about standing up to the president, and it was about the importance of Democrats winning back the House. What was striking is that her message seemed to be very different. I mean, I know that, you know, in the clip she was talking about economic message, but it was also very personal against him, meaning talking about how he'd been there for 20 years and what has he done, talking about his kids living in the D.C. area rather than in the district, talking about his accepting corporate PAC contributions. And so it was two very different messages. And I think it's akin to, I think this is similar to the Tea Party movement in that I think part of the Tea Party movement was about reforming the Republican Party first and then taking on Democrats. And I kind of hear that with Ocasio-Cortez's message, in that let's reform the Democratic Party first, and the Democratic message, and then we'll take on the Republicans.
Well, you mentioned so many things in that answer just now I want to talk about all of it. First of all, you mentioned that he talked about Trump and she didn't, and there's always there's a debate within the Democratic Party of whether this should be an anti-Trump party or a party that deals with economic issues like she seemed to do. And it was also, you know, he was also rumored to be looking down the line at a run for speaker, maybe even challenging Nancy Pelosi. Do you think his national ambitions, his look at the national picture, hurt him at home?
I think that could be part of it. I mean, I think you and I would agree that campaigns are complex organisms, and isolating individual aspects of a campaign is difficult. I mean, I think it was probably a culmination of a lot of things. I do think the Eric Cantor comparison is relevant or applicable in that way because of the rising aspirations. But there are other things going on, too. I mean, the demographics of the district had been changing, and I think that Ocasio-Cortez is hitting the right message at the right time. It was just an interesting primary to me because in some other primaries, we're seeing, you know, who can stand up to the president the loudest or the most. And that's really not, she was coming at it from an implicit opposition to the president rather than explicit. And it clearly worked. In the general election, Democrats are going to have to figure out a way, though, to harness this energy on the left, the resistance, but yet have the message be, I think, a little bit different, maybe a check and balance message rather than resist, oppose, and yell.
You mentioned Eric Cantor. Of course, he was the former House Majority Leader in Virginia who got beaten by David Bratton, a huge upset a few years ago. And just 2 weeks ago, we were talking about the defeat of Mark Sanford in South Carolina and what that meant for the Republican Party. But I guess Joe Crowley's defeat is, the question is, what does it mean for the Democrats? Because the split in the party between the establishment, which was Hillary Clinton, which was Joe Crowley, and the insurgent progressives, you know, we're not going to take this anymore, like the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, as well as her victory. It just seems like a different approach, and that's what the Democrats seem to, as you say, they seem to be having to decide among themselves, what are we going to present to the American people before we start going after the Republicans?
Yeah, I think this is just more evidence that the Democratic Party is divided. I think some people might explain it away, the Crowley loss away, as a demographic change and having his eye looking ahead to the next game without defeating the opponent that's right in front of you. But I view this as a trend. I think Bernie Sanders is evidence of an anti-establishment wave. The 63 House Democrats who voted against Nancy Pelosi in the last leadership race. De Leon challenging Dianne Feinstein in California. The vocal criticism against the DCCC. I think that the power, or at least the fear, of the Democratic establishment is really eroding, and it's going to even manifest itself further in 2020 Senate primaries and in the presidential race. But at the same time, I think it's important to remember that a party can be divided and still win elections. The Republicans are the best example of this. They've been fighting the Tea Party and the establishment and the conservatives. They think McConnell's not conservative enough. And where did that civil war get the Republicans? It got them the House, the Senate, and the White House. And that's because in the general elections, they had a common enemy in President Obama. Democrats are divided, but they have a powerful uniter in President Donald J. Trump. And so I think they can still do well in November, even though there's this fighting right now.
But the Democratic, we should also point out that the Democratic leadership in the House, at least, is led by the 78-year-old Nancy Pelosi and the 79-year-old Steny Hoyer. Is there any message there in the victory of Ocasio-Cortez?
Well, I mean, I think she'll clearly be at 28 years old, she'll be a young new member. I believe she'll be the youngest woman ever elected to the House. And there was already part of the Democratic Party saying, look, it's time for a change. It's time for a generational change. The question is who? You know, who's going to step up? Who's going to have enough votes to take the leadership mantle? And that's what we're waiting for. I mean, Crowley was kind of positioning himself as that, but even a congressman in his 50s isn't exactly maybe the fresh face that some in the party are looking for. But if you can talk about change and wanting change, but there has to be a vehicle and a candidate there to take advantage of it.
You know, one thing we need to do, I think, I mean, in the big picture and look at this, this district covered neighborhoods in Queens and the Bronx, which is hardly representative of the nation. But so are we making too much of this primary result, or is this beyond the neighborhoods of New York City and more about wither the Democratic Party?
I think there were both local and national aspects. I mean, if this had happened in a vacuum, I guess, absent of Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential candidacy and absent a lot of other things, then sure, we could say this was local. But I don't believe that Ocasio-Cortez would have won or gotten as far if the foundation of kind of the progressive movement, the left, the insurgent resistance against the President Trump. I just don't know that. I don't think all of that comes together just at the local level for her to win. So I think it was a combination of both.
And it also sends another signal about the about this year's class of female candidates.
Yeah, and Tuesday was kind of, I think, maybe mixed results for some women candidates. You know, for example, in Maryland's 6th District, David Trone, who's spent, I believe, almost $25 million over the last 4 years trying to get a seat in Congress, defeated a credible woman. We saw some women lose in Colorado's gubernatorial primary. Kind of some mixed results, but
Yvette Clark in New York City almost lost her seat.
Right, yeah, I think that ended up being 52-48, but it was within hundreds of votes for much of primary night. It's a big win, I think, for the progressives and left, and I think it's only going to embolden people to either run or try to get traction for their candidacies that are already going on. And you know, Democrats, they've enjoyed watching Republicans eat themselves alive in primaries, but winter has come for the Democratic Party.
Nathan Gonzalez is the editor and publisher of Inside Elections. Nathan, great analysis on this race. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Baby, what a big surprise.
Those who listen to this program know a key tenet of our philosophy. We love politics. And despite the skepticism of a few, we don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican, liberal or conservative. What we don't care for is the growing lack of civility in politics. We especially don't like the lying, the bullying, the public ridiculing, the nastiness, the bigotry, the ignorance. And we truly abhor the growing intolerance of democratic ideals. It is happening not just in the U.S., but the U.S. was supposed to be the bulwark against the creeping know-nothingism. A new study by the Freedom House, the George W. Bush Institute, and the University of Pennsylvania's Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement suggests that confidence in democracy may be in some jeopardy. Half the country says the U.S. is, quote, in real danger of becoming a non-democratic authoritarian country. 55% see democracy as weak. 68% says it's getting weaker. 80% indicate concern about the condition of democracy in the country. Lindsay Lloyd is the deputy director of the Human Freedom Initiative at the George W. Bush Institute, and he joins us now. Lindsay, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Hi, Ken. Nice to talk to you.
Well, in a nutshell, what does this study tell us?
Well, I think it started, from a concern over the health of our democracy here domestically. We were thinking about this issue, and our two partners were also kind of pondering this over the course of last year. Freedom House, one of the oldest, most respected human rights organizations in the U.S., founded by Eleanor Roosevelt and Wendell Willkie. The Penn Biden Center, a new think tank research institute founded by the former vice president, affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania, and we at the George W. Bush Institute, where we try and look at the values and the principles of George and Laura Bush, and that sort of influences our work. So these are themes that we've been thinking about, and as we started thinking about it, we realized we really don't know all that much about them. Everybody, I think, in the 2016 election year, we had obviously a very contentious year. 2017 seemed very rocky to many of us. But we really didn't know sort of how Americans feel about their democracy. What are they really saying and thinking about it? So we wanted to do a study and learn more and form this, I think, rather unusual partnership across party lines to do some public opinion research. So that sort of kicked off the project, and just last few days, we've actually released this to the public.
You've long been involved in advancing freedom and democracy in the world. It feels almost alarming that freedom and democracy may be under attack here at home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things about democracy, I did, before coming to the Bush Institute, I worked to develop democratic political systems in the former communist states of Central and Eastern Europe. And one of the things I think that came out of that experience, and we see it here, democracy is not a one-and-done sort of thing. It's not one free election makes a democracy. It's just the reverse. It's a process that goes on over a period of decades. We see this in Hungary right now, where they have a democratic system, but it has become less democratic. They've sort of been sliding backwards over the last several years. So there's a responsibility, I think, for citizens to stay invested, to do the obvious things like voting or calling their congressman or you know, writing a letter to the editor or joining a march, you know, that kind of thing. All that really does matter. It's what makes our civic culture rich and important and timeless.
But Hungary doesn't have a history of democratic government the way we do here. So I guess the question is, what accounts for the growing questioning of democracy in the U.S.?
I think what we found in the research is a sense that democracy, our democracy, isn't necessarily delivering. You know, we read about things like gridlock. We read about things like partisan polarization. And this is not something that sprung up just overnight. This has been building for, I think, many years. You know, you go back, you look at things like, you know, Supreme Court nominations. You look at a president being impeached. You look at the very bitter election of 2000. It's very hard to find moments of national unity from Watergate onward. You know, you can probably count them on one hand. And I think we've tended to retreat into our camps. We get our media information from different media sources these days. You know, it used to be everybody sat down and watched Walter Cronkite or one of his two rivals, but now, you know, people sort of self-select where they get their news, and I think that colors our perceptions of the world.
You know, I think there were those back in the 1930s who feared that Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal were a threat to the American way of life. And then there was, of course, the fear of communism after World War II, the rise of Joseph McCarthy. You mentioned Watergate about at a time when people were questioning American ideals. And I don't want to make this certainly this is not a partisan conversation we should be having. But what happens when you have a president who has spoken of admiration for authoritarian figures, or somebody who's called the media the enemy of the American people? Does that threaten democracy here?
I don't know that it threatens democracy, but it's certainly a different tone. You know, one of the great things about our system is that it is resilient. We started with a brilliantly inspired document, the Constitution. But it was an imperfect document where it excluded half the population women. It excluded anybody who wasn't a white male property owner, basically. And over time, we've learned to correct those mistakes and adapt to them. So we have that resilience. The founders gifted us something really remarkable, which is a system of checks and balances. And at a time when one branch is perhaps a little bit off track, it's incumbent that the other branches are there to sort of pull things back towards the center. We also have a federal system where the states retain important authorities and important powers. And so if the federal government, if the national government is going too far in one direction, the states have an opportunity and a responsibility to push back.
There are people, obviously, who are looking at this system, our American system, our American way of life, and coming up with things they don't like. Clearly, I mean, they see racism in many things. They see too much money in politics. Is that the kind of thing you're seeing in your study?
Very much so. When we ask people, you know, what was wrong with our democracy, those are two of the top answers right there, really. And what was interesting is on the money question, of the role of money in our political system. That was sort of across the board. It didn't matter if you were conservative, liberal, white, black. You know, everybody agreed that the role of money, that special interests are the ones that get heard. We did focus groups along with this research, and we heard that over and over again, that if you want to be heard, you have to have money, and they're only listening to moneyed interests. The question of race, I think, was really interesting because there isn't this across-the-board agreement here. We saw really a sharp divide. We asked people, you know, whether they thought issues were getting better or getting worse in America. On the issue of sort of race relations, we saw whites and non-whites with dramatically different views. We saw Republicans and Democrats with dramatically different views, where whites were saying that, oh, no, things have gotten better, and non-whites were saying, hold on a second, we don't see that. So overall, we found that the people who are sort of the most invested in our system are the people who are doing best. The people who, you know, saw things as doing well were generally making more money. They were better educated. They were whiter. And those who were seeing a lot of these flaws tended to be the people who weren't profiting quite as much from our system. So it gets back to what I was saying about our democracy delivering. Is our government solving the ordinary around the kitchen table concerns of Americans? And most Americans are saying, no, right now it's not.
And I was going to add to that. What happens when a leader stands up and says the system is rigged? Or what happens when people think a foreign government is trying to sway the election? What does that do to faith in democracy?
I think when a leader says the system is rigged or there are charges that foreign interests have manipulated our system, it chips away at the trust and the confidence that people see or have in our government. And that came across in our poll. We asked about, I think it was 12 different institutions, both governmental and non-governmental, about people's confidence in them. And almost across the board, they're in the negative ranges. The only one where there were positive ratings were on local police, by then only narrowly, and only among whites. So on, you know, whether it's Congress or the courts or the bureaucracy, you know, other institutions, people just don't have confidence in them. And to have leaders chipping away at that confidence is obviously harmful.
I guess the thing I'm left with, are you optimistic for the future, and is there a reason to be optimistic?
Yeah, we are optimistic, and that's why we did this project. The Bush Institute, our partners at the Penn Biden Center and at Freedom House, all are deeply committed to this country. We obviously come at it from different partisan perspectives, from different political perspectives. There are some signs in this survey work of American citizens being optimistic about it. We had, you know, for example, overwhelming support for ideas like how do we improve civic education so that when kids graduate high school, they understand how the government works and what the government does and their role in it. We saw tremendous interest and support for the concept of national service, not necessarily, you know, reinstituting the draft, but things like military service or volunteer work, gap years, all those kind of things, I think people responded to and felt were worthwhile. How important is it to you to live in a democracy? We had better than 8 in 10 saying it was absolutely or very important.
Lindsay Lloyd is a deputy director of the Human Freedom Initiative at the George W. Bush Institute, which, along with the Freedom House and the Penn Biden Center, has conducted a study about the future of democracy in the United States, a most sobering study. Lindsay, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Carter, Begin, and Sadat, Brezhnev, Deng, and Castro. Every day negotiate us closer to disaster. Idi Amin and the Shah and Al-Fatah is quite bizarre. I could never get the hang of ideology.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, when was the last time a state held two Senate elections at the same time and the two winners were not from the same party? The answer, 1966 in South Carolina. For the first seat, Strom Thurmond, a Republican, was reelected. The other seat was a special election to succeed the late Senator Olin Johnston. Former Governor Fritz Hollings, a Democrat, was victorious in that one. And the randomly selected winner is Gene Meninga of Grand Rapids, Michigan. Gene wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Yes, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind.
These are partisan times, and sad to report, uncivil and intolerant times as well. To many people, politics has become a blood sport, us against them. Compromise means surrender. That's why it was interesting to see how many people, liberals as well as conservatives, were saddened by the death last week of Charles Krauthammer. The longtime conservative voice on Fox News as well as on the Washington Post op-ed page, Krauthammer died of cancer at the age of 68. His influence was tremendous. Presidents cited him, for better or worse. He responded to praise from Bill Clinton in his usual humorous fashion.
Read Charles Krauthammer's column in the Post. He's a brilliant man.
Well, you know, when you get praise from President Clinton and you're from my side of the aisle, that means that my career's done. I mean, I'm toast.
He could, on the one hand, eviscerate Barack Obama, as he did here on Fox News when Obama's executive order on immigration was stopped by the Supreme Court in 2016.
And this is the culmination of a long string of decisions issued by the Supreme Court and by lower courts, which have admonished this president for clearly overstepping the boundaries of his authority. In this case, it was quite egregious. It was simply not in the president's power to do it. And just because the president wants to do something that Congress will not do, it does not give him the authority to do it.
While at the same time dismissing Donald Trump as someone he could possibly vote for.
The fact is, I cannot vote for Donald Trump. I thought that on the day he announced. I said it that night. I said on special report, I didn't think he was even a serious candidate. I got that wrong about the fact that he wouldn't be a factor. But I think I got it right that he's unfit for the presidency, and I've never changed my mind on that.
He didn't change his mind after the election either.
Presidents don't talk like this. They never have. This is what it sounds like when you're living in a banana republic.
Trump was aware of the criticism, as he made clear on Fox and Friends prior to the election.
As far as Charles Krauthammer, I'm not a fan of his. I think he's a highly overrated pundit. He's wrong on so many things.
Krauthammer never shied away from conservative positions, but he was an independent thinker who never relied on predictable, knee-jerk slogans. And those who knew him, from the left or the right, mourn his passing. Mara Liasson is NPR's national political correspondent who spent years sitting next to Krauthammer on Fox's Sunday programs. Mara, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Happy to be here.
Well, you know, it's unusual these days to see pundits from the right or the left being mourned, you know, by the other side. But Charles Krauthammer had a lot of people of, shall we say, the liberal persuasion he counted as friends.
Well, that's for sure. But that's because Charles was an example of, unfortunately, a dying breed, a disappearing breed, which is he was a conservative intellectual. He was not a partisan hack. There was nothing tribal about Charles Krauthammer. He came to his opinions through reason and study, and he wasn't just a member of a team. That's the big problem with politics today, is so tribal. It doesn't matter what the guy on your side says. You're just going to be with him no matter what. And Charles was a conservative, and he wasn't really a never-Trumper. In other words, he wasn't out there trying to stop Trump necessarily. And when Trump did something that he thought was conservative, and of course Trump has done many, many things that conservatives like, he praised him for it. But when he didn't, when he broke the norms of little d democracy in terms of the things he said or the way he went about undermining democratic institutions, Charles called him out for that too. And that's why I think he was so beloved across the political spectrum.
You know, he was once a speechwriter for Walter Mondale and a writer for the New Republic. Did he ever talk to you about his days as a liberal?
No, but he did have a slow evolution, and there were a bunch of people, we used to call them neocons, who had been Democrats. and they felt the party left them on foreign policy, on being kind of a muscular defender of democracy, and on the size of government. But Charles moved right, but that doesn't mean that he was going to move into the new version of republicanism, which is a kind of nativist, isolationist space, which is where Trump is.
He was, I remember back in the day, he was a strong advocate for the invasion of Iraq. Did he ever back down from that? Did he ever talk about that kind of decision or that kind of...
That's a really good question. I can't remember a time that Charles ever talked about it. He might have, but I don't remember a time on the panel, for instance, where he said, you know, I was wrong about that. I think he was more of the camp that it might not have turned out the way that people like Dick Cheney or other boosters of the war thought it would, but it was important to stay there, kind of, we broke it, we owned it, you know, stay there, not to pull out. The surge was important, and I think he was opposed to Barack Obama's policy of announcing an end date to the American effort there.
What was he like to work with?
He was a delightful person. The thing about Charles is he was so sweet. He was sunny. And he was always, I've never seen Charles dark or angry. And this is a guy who spent his entire adult life in a wheelchair. You know, he was incredibly kind and he was affectionate and he really had a first-class personality. And one thing I remember him telling me is when he was in the hospital after he broke his neck and was paralyzed pretty high up on his spinal cord, he said there were two kinds of people, people who just couldn't accept their fate and get on with life, and people who could, and he clearly could. You know, he had the right kind of personality that could just, you know, figure out how to keep on going. And he was a wonderful, wonderful human being. I feel very lucky that I got to sit next to him, mostly because I was usually the only female person on the panel, so I got to be in the middle, and I sat next to Charles. But I'm so lucky that I got to spend all that time with him.
You know, you talk about all the things that he was and his good nature and everything. I don't remember him criticizing an opponent in nasty terms or launching a personal attack. There was no question.
No.
He was conservative, but not nasty or personal.
No, he was an intellectual. He was a conservative intellectual. He was learned. You know, he was very involved in Jewish learning and teaching and education. You know, he was a Jewish scholar, too, and he supported Jewish education. He and his wife sponsored a wonderful music series at the Kennedy Center called Pro Musica Hebraica, where they found works of little-known or forgotten Jewish composers, and they brought incredible musicians to play those at the Kennedy Center. He was an extraordinary guy, and I really feel that his loss now, right when politics is devolving into its worst state, certainly of my lifetime, this is when his loss is felt the most.
You know, as we're defining what conservatism is, and of course, we're redefining it every day with every new Trump policy, but what does it say about the future of conservatism, and are there any Charles Krauthammers left?
That's a really good question. I think there are people, there's nobody, I think, at his level, but there are plenty of people who are serious conservatives who are not engaged in the kind of tribal warfare. I mean, I'm just thinking Jonah Goldberg, Ben Domenech, George Will. Of course, George Will has kind of left the Republican Party. That doesn't mean he's not a conservative. And he's become a really strong antagonist to Trump, but he's still bases it on principles and the Constitution. You know, Charles Krauthammer was the opposite of name-calling and all the things that liberals don't like about Donald Trump and all the things that conservatives complain about the left or liberals when they harass members of the Trump administration at the movies or at a restaurant. I mean, Charles was the complete, total opposite of all of that.
It sounds like a true gentleman.
He really was.
Mara Liasson is NPR's national political correspondent. For years, she served together as a panelist with Charles Krauthammer on Fox News' special report with Brett Baer. Krauthammer died last week of cancer. He was 68 years old. Mara, thanks so much for sharing your memories.
Thanks for having me.
Right, right, you're bloody well right. You got a bloody right to say. Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.